This is Audible.
Monster Empire, written by Michael Scott Earle, narrated by James Patrick Cronin. Chapter 1.
It's hotter than the devil's asshole after eating a ghost pepper. Stay hydrated, boys. I glanced up at the Syrian sun as I drank from my camelback. The heat had never bothered me much, but heatstroke was a major threat in a place like this, and I didn't need any of my soldiers taking a dirt nap. It was hard enough carrying a full molly pack and our battle rattle without it being 100 degrees outside, but it wasn't even noon yet. We were going to be in for a crazy hot day in the next few hours. I squeezed some water from my pack on my face to clean off the dirt. The wind blew across the ancient site steadily, but it offered no relief from the stifling heat. It felt like I was in a sauna with a blow dryer on my face, one that spewed forth not only hot air but sand and dust as well. Even after rinsing out my mouth, I could still feel the sand in my teeth, and a thin film of dust coated my tongue. Right about then, I would have given my left nut for a cold beer. We'd arrived a few hours before midday to secure the ancient city of Palmyra in central Syria, after reports came in that the site was once again being targeted by ISIS. They had attacked the temple of Baal Shamin a few years back and left only a pair of pillars standing where the ancient temple had once been. It was a shame, really. The temple had stood for nearly 2,000 years, but it had been reduced to nothing but rubble in mere seconds. My squad's job was to sweep the city for landmines, repair the roads leading in, and secure the site for the archaeologists. The place was over 200 acres of dirt, broken columns, half-crumbled arches, temples, and even an ancient Roman-looking amphitheater. It was far too large for my squad of 9 men to patrol properly, but backup was set to arrive shortly after noon. Until then, I ordered my men to focus on the roads. We hadn't found any landmines or IEDs, but that wasn't much of a surprise. Most likely, the threat from ISIS was a bluff, but it was up to grunts like me to ensure historical sites like this remained intact through the conflict. Aside from securing the roads, we had been instructed to focus on the Temple of Nebu. I had no idea what made the temple so important, since all that was left of it was a square sandstone slab with some markings on it and 3 pillars, but I didn't need to know. I just did what I was told. That's what you did in the army, especially when you were a sapper. Do as you're told. Do your job. Shut up and color. Don't stand out or showboat. Just perform. My plan after returning to the States was to join my father in the family business. He was an engineer like me, and I guess his passion for creation rubbed off on me. For as long as I could remember, I'd loved to build things. And it wasn't the final product that I was most in love with, but the process, the math, the calculations, the precision. The idea of imagining something and then making it a reality had always appealed to me. In my mind, creation had always been the thing that put us apart from other animals. Sure, spiders could spin webs and beavers could build dams, but it was all they did. Humans, on the other hand, could imagine almost anything and make it a reality. It was a scary thought sometimes, but at other times it was uplifting. I was well aware of the power of the mind, the power of focus and positive thinking. But that wasn't all a person needed. Plans were vital, and the ability to make and stick to plans was what separated the doers from the dreamers.
"Hey, Sergeant," said Johnson, a young cocky kid from Texas who was always grinning. "You know why they really want us to secure this place?"
I said nothing as I scoured the distant pillars and half-crumbled walls.
"I got a feeling you're going to tell us," McAllister said as he patted down the last shovelful of dirt onto the road. He was a freckle-faced farm boy from Indiana with broad shoulders and big arms. He stood 6'2" and was almost as tall as me. He was a hell of a worker, unlike Johnson, who always seemed to be screwing around.
Johnson let the tension build up and spat in the dirt. When he was sure he had our unbridled attention, he finally divulged his secret.
"The temple is a fucking stargate."
"Oh man, this shit again," McAllister groaned. But Johnson relished in his own bullshit and smiled wider.
"Yep, I read about it in a book by that crazy-looking dude from Ancient Aliens. Which one? I asked. The dude with the wild hair and all the internet memes? Johnson replied as he narrowed his eyes and held out his hands. You read his book, but you don't remember his name? I asked, and Johnson shrugged. Can't remember them all, Sergeant. Shit, 99% of my brain's hard drive is reserved for the Spank Bank. As if we didn't know what the Spank Bank was, Johnson stuck out his tongue and pretended to pound his groin. You know what, Johnson, it helps to clear your Spank Bank if you only keep one woman in mind, I said. Oh, yeah? Who do you think about? I ignored him, but McAllister took the bait. Your mom? Johnson's face blanched. You see, McAllister continued, every time you say something stupid, I allot myself one more fantasy about your mother. And I'll tell you, Johnson, I've got a fucking double feature going on down there. Man, that's fucked up, said Johnson. All right. I had to put an end to the lax attitude. Let's keep the chatter down. We've got to sweep the remainder of the road for landmines, and there are still three more holes to fill before the trucks can get through. So get to it. I climbed up onto one of the hundreds of stone slabs strewn throughout the site and surveyed the north through my binoculars. There hadn't been any other reports of ISIS activity in the region, and I didn't really expect trouble, but I liked to treat every mission the same. I'd seen too many men pay the ultimate price for letting their guard down, and I wasn't going to add my name to that long list of casualties. The big, round, orange guy in the sky turned up the temperature a few more agonizing notches as late morning turned into early afternoon. I was beginning to get a little soggy at that point, and the molly pack on my back continued to get heavier. My men were holding up all right, considering there was no shade to be found, and the temperature was inching over into triple digits. The trick to beating the heat was to remain well hydrated and to know your limits. A big ego is a soldier's worst enemy in a place like this. Johnson had a large head on his shoulders, but that was to be expected with a kid from Texas. I liked the guy, but since I was a few years his senior, I had the experience and rank to make sure he didn't mess up and get himself killed. As though he sensed me thinking about him, Johnson sauntered over the fresh dirt we had just packed into a huge hole in the road. "How you feel about shipping home in a week, Sergeant?" he said. He looked to have recovered from the insult and wiggled his eyebrows at me as he spoke. I'm not thinking about that right now. I accentuated the point with a heavy sigh. Shit, he said and spit on the dirt. I bet you can't wait to get your hands on some 100% USDA-approved good old-fashioned homegrown titties. I almost laughed, but I didn't want to give him any encouragement. We aren't going to be getting any women if we don't get back from this mission alive, so stay frosty. Shit, Johnson said, spitting on the ground again. This mission is a piece of cake. I doubt that. Sergeant Jewell, we've got company, Gibson called over the radio. Gibson was Fire Team 2's leader, and he and his men had been searching for IEDs north of my location. What do you see? I hissed into the radio. Two trucks flying the black flag? Fuck, I said under my breath. ETA? 2-3 minutes? Looks like they got a couple of rocket launchers. Get off the road and get ready to say hello, I said into the radio as I turned to McAllister. Get a hold of command and let them know we're going to need a Reaper drone out here, fucking pronto. On it, Sergeant. And find out where the hell our backup unit is. I used my binoculars to search the dusty terrain to the north, but the enemy was still hidden behind the raised land. There was little chance that the Air Force would be able to get the Reaper drone to us in time, so we had to hold them off until it arrived. They're splitting up east and west, Gibson said over the radio. Fire Team 2, stay with the truck heading east. Fire Team 1, take cover to the west. I ordered, and the two men with me grabbed their gear and scrambled off the road toward a group of pillars that would give them an open view of the western side of the site. The rest of my team met up with us a few moments later, and we all hunkered down. With any luck, the ISIS fighters would take their time to secure the site before moving in, and the Reaper would have time to get to us. 2 minutes later, one of their trucks appeared in the distance, and I confirmed what Gibson had reported. There were at least two adult-aged males in the back of the dark brown truck carrying rocket launchers. If the intelligence the army had received was correct, they were also hell-bent on destroying the temple right behind me.
The drone will be here in 10 minutes, McAllister reported.
That's 10 minutes we don't have,
Johnson said as he white-knuckled his machine gun. We'll make it work, Johnson, I said. Then I radioed Lucas, Fire Team 1's sniper. You keep a bead on those rocket launchers. Any indication that they're preparing to fire, I want you to introduce them to Allah.
Affirmative, he called back. I looked to where I knew he had taken up his perch on a crumbling pillar that was still 12 feet tall, but I didn't see him there. That was a good thing. If I couldn't see him, then neither could our enemies. I was a little more than pissed that my guys had spotted the enemy first. The United States spent $1 bazillion on satellite imaging and could reportedly zoom in on a naked starlet's nipples sunbathing in the Hollywood Hills, but they couldn't see 2 big-ass trucks driving through the desert.
So much for our tax dollars at work.
We all waited on our bellies behind the crumbled sandstone pillars. The other team hadn't reported anything, and I took that as a good sign, so I checked my watch. It had been 2 minutes since McAllister reported the Reaper's ETA, so we only had to sweat for 8 more minutes. But a lot could happen in 8 minutes. I'd seen some action in Afghanistan during my 2 tours, and I'd been in worse situations before. However, now I was on the last leg of my 3rd tour, and I was feeling a bit paranoid. There were plenty of stories about men eating a bullet a few days before they shipped home, and I didn't want my boys to be added to that number. My soldiers had family waiting for them. I didn't have a wife or kids to come back to, but both of my parents were still alive, and I was close to my siblings. I spied the enemy through my binoculars as I hugged the ground. When the truck stopped about 150 yards away, the men poured out of it like it was a clown car. There were 8 ISIS fighters in all, 6 with machine guns and 2 carrying green-tipped rocket launchers. They took their time, like I had hoped, and surveyed the surroundings while they spoke in hushed tones. Their voices came to me as incoherent murmurs, but it sounded like 2 of them were arguing. I saw one man point to the temple right behind my team and say something to the other man that sounded final. I glanced at my watch. 2 minutes had passed, and 6 remained. I mentally urged the other man to argue against blowing up the temple, but he gave up. If they came too close or raised those rockets, we would be forced to engage. But if they took just a few more minutes, the Reaper would put them down before we had to. I was hoping for the latter. 1 minute passed while the men argued, and now only 5 remained. Waiting for that Reaper was like wading through deep mud. The seconds ticked by with an agonizing crawl, and sweat dripped down my forehead slower than molasses, rode the bridge of my nose, and quivered there for an eon before it dripped into the dirt. Then suddenly someone hit fast forward, and one of the men carrying a rocket launcher moved a few dozen feet to the south to get a better angle. He flipped up the crosshairs, raised the weapon onto his shoulder, closed his left eye, and touched his finger gently to the firing mechanism. And that was the last thing he did. Our sniper put a bullet between the man's eyes, and the back of his head blew out in a spray of crimson and gray-colored gore. His body crumpled to the ground, and a heartbeat later, all hell broke loose. The enemy soldiers opened fire. It was more of a spray and pray than anything, since none of the bullets came close to my men or me. I knew that they hadn't seen us yet. They were just giving themselves some cover as they ran back to their truck. Lucas put another one of the enemies down with a well-placed shot to the middle of the back. A puff of red mist exploded out the front of the man's dusty jacket, and he did a face plant on the grill of the truck. To the east, I heard more gunfire. "Fire Team 2, report," I said into my mic. The team leader's frantic voice came through my earpiece. "They got a fucking jump on us!" Gunfire ensued and barked loudly in my earpiece. "They've got us pinned in a shallow grave! Fuck!" An explosion rocked the ancient site, and for a moment there was only silence. I looked east and saw a plume of dust rising into the air. My heart skipped a beat, and shit got real. "Gibson, report!" I hissed into my mic. Nothing. "Take those fuckers out," I ordered my men, and they all rose from their cover and began riddling the truck with bullets. We had our targets pinned down and had the higher ground, but the other team was in a bad spot. I had to help.
Keep the pressure on and don't let those fucks fire the rockets, I yelled at my team. I'm going to back up Team 2.
I'm coming with you, said Johnson with a look of determination.
Negative, soldier, do what I fucking told you to do. McAllister, you're in charge.
I hunched low and raced through the broken pillars and piles of crumbled sandstone blocks toward the sounds of gunfire. The truck that had gone east was more than 300 yards away and below my line of sight, but that was a good thing. It meant that I would have the higher ground. I didn't have a sniper rifle, but my M4 had an effective range of about 550 yards, and I was a damn good shot. I was even better under pressure. 1 minute after I left Team 1, I spotted the enemy and dove behind a weathered half-wall. There were 6 ISIS fighters holding down Fire Team 2 with bursts of rifle fire, and smoke rose from a spot 30 yards to my right, along the same wall I was hiding behind. I could see Team 2 down there huddled in a trench that surrounded the temple grounds. It didn't look like any of them were injured, but they wouldn't last long pinned down like that. One grenade could have ended all their lives at once. To their credit, they were staying relatively calm from what I could see, and they kept the pressure on with steady defensive fire. I glanced at my watch and saw that the Reaper was due in 2 minutes. I popped up from my cover and lit into one of the men hiding behind the truck. He was crouched behind the right corner of the tailgate, and my bullets destroyed the brake light and painted war graffiti all over the man's chest. The other fighters saw me and opened fire in my direction, but I ducked down a split second after my last round exploded from the barrel. Then I low-crawled 10 yards to my right along the wall as bullets slammed into it. My heart hammered in my chest. It thumped in my ears. The adrenaline was making me shaky, and I white-knuckled my weapon. We just had to hold out for a few more minutes, and the ISIS fighters would be turned into jihad kebabs by the drone. Another glance at my watch told me that we had only 1 more minute to wait. Gunfire continued to erupt from the west, and I glanced in that direction, hoping that Team 1 could hold off the other fighters for a little while longer. A cry of pain whipped my head back around, and I dared a peek over the low wall. One of my men had been hit in the shoulder, but he was still alive and cursing, so I guessed that he still had some fight left in him. I popped up again and dumped my mag into the truck, hoping to get the fighter's attention off my men. It worked a little too well. One of the men with a rocket launcher popped up from behind the truck and fired at my position, so I sprang up from my spot, sprinted toward the thickest part of the wall, kissed my ass goodbye, and dove for my life. The explosion rocked me like the stacked speakers at a metal concert, and I landed hard on a pile of rubble. Dirt and debris rained down on me as I scrambled to keep moving, but my ears were ringing and my head was spinning. I was almost deaf to the sounds of battle around me and half blinded by the dust and smoke. My mouth and eyes were full of sand, and the acrid stench of gunpowder seemed stuck in my nose. Confusion began to set in as my ears adjusted, and I became aware of distant gunfire. Then I remembered my men trapped in the trench, and my instincts took over. I picked myself up from the debris and brought my carbine to bear as I glanced around the side of the pillar. I instantly wished I hadn't looked, since bullets immediately ripped into the ancient landmark and speckled my face with tiny chunks of stone. As my vision cleared, I saw that 3 men had broken off from the main group and were heading around the back of the truck so that they could come at me from the south. The angle put their vehicle between them and my men's line of fire, so I knew I was about to have an even more serious problem on my hands. If I turned the corner again, it would likely be the last thing I did, so I used the cover of the pillar and the short wall to run back toward the temple. I didn't bother looking at my watch. I knew that the Reaper was well past due, but even if it reached us now, the Air Force wouldn't risk destroying the temple. I was on my own. There wasn't much left of the temple aside from a chunk of square sandstone with 3 pillars still standing on one side, but it was enough to hide behind, so I dove to the safety offered by that bit of cover as bullets riddled the ground behind me like kamikaze metal wasps. I landed on my side, rolled, and popped up to my feet. Then I pressed my back against the sandstone and listened. The gunfire stopped, but I didn't take it as a good sign. Then I saw it. The Reaper had finally arrived, I heard the warning cries of the men who had pursued me to the temple, and I smiled to myself.
"You boys are really fucked now," I yelled over my shoulder.
"Sergeant, get out of there!"
Lucas's words in my earpiece came to me about the same time as the sound of a rocket launcher firing. There wasn't much time for thinking, so I took 3 bounding steps and leaped for a depression behind the temple as the rocket exploded. The world beneath me seemed to spin as I fell. My ears rang so bad, I figured that they must have been bleeding, and for a millisecond, some part of my brain wondered if I would ever hear again. My vision turned black, and I guessed I had just taken a point-blank blast. My body went numb, and I realized that I was probably going to die. But I didn't die. Instead, I hit the ground hard and the air exploded from my dusty lungs. I was happy to be alive, but when my vision cleared, I saw that the roof of the temple was beginning to crumble. I covered my head to protect it from the falling stone and other debris, but the danger did not come from above. Instead, the ground began to vibrate, and the sand beneath my boots and knees began to disappear. I glanced back and saw that it was falling into a wide hole which had been created when the temple was hit. More sand and earth gave way, and I clawed at the nearby rocks as I tried to escape the sinkhole. The ground beneath me suddenly disappeared, and I was sliding down like a boogie boarder riding a wave. I fell a good 10 feet before I slammed into a ledge, missed a handhold, and slid off another ledge. The next fall brought me another 10 feet, but I managed to get my boots under me as I fell and landed on a small ledge that jutted out from the wall without breaking my neck. The shock of what had happened, and the fact that I was still alive, left me feeling almost giddy. But my celebration was short-lived when I looked up. 2 ISIS fighters were staring down at me from the lip of the crater and were screaming something about Allah. If they opened fire, I would be a dead man. I looked down and expected to see what was left of the temple and other debris still falling into the abyss. But to my surprise, they did not fall into darkness, but into a bright blue light. I blinked, unable to believe my eyes. About 100 feet below me, down at the bottom of the 10-foot-wide circular pit, was turquoise blue water. It even looked like the sun shone through it. But of course, that was impossible. A bullet hit the wall beside me, and I realized then that the sling ripped off and I dropped my rifle. I let out a string of curses, pulled my sidearm, and squeezed off 3 rounds. The men ducked back from the opening, and I was safe for the time being. But if I remained on the ledge, I would be a sitting duck. My only salvation lay at the bottom of the pit, in the pristine, sunlit waters that had no right being at the bottom of a sun-baked desert. I couldn't rely on my men to get me out of this one, and the Reaper wasn't going to fire on the site of the ancient temple. All I had to do was drop into the waters below and wait out the battle on the surface, and eventually my people would drop down a rope. At least, that was the plan. The enemies above me pointed their AKs into the pit blindly and fired, and I did the only thing I could do. I quickly peeled off my pack, removed my Kevlar, put the pack back on, and jumped feet first into the hole. Bullets ricocheted through the pit, and I screamed in defiance as I fell with my middle finger held high. It wasn't the most graceful of leaps, and I bounced off the walls like a pinball. My molly pack protected my back from the rough stone of the natural well, but I hit my shoulder pretty hard as I ping-ponged my way down, down, down. The drop was much farther than I had estimated, at least another 100 feet more, and I fell for so long that I had time to let out my earlier breath and take another. When I finally hit the water, the impact was jarring. One of my legs twisted to the side, and I dipped backward as I sank. I had trained for shit like this, and I remembered to remain calm and steadily swim for the surface. I could see a shimmering light above me, and for a moment I thought it must be the sun. But I was below the surface of the earth, likely in a natural underground lake, and the sun hadn't been high enough for me to see through the natural well above. Whatever it was, it meant air, it meant safety, and I pumped my arms and legs.
It felt like I would never break through to the surface, and when I finally did, I let the carbon dioxide explode from my lungs before I took in greedy gulps of fresh air. I opened my eyes, thankful to still be breathing. And that's when I saw two suns sitting high in the sky. Salt water stung my eyes, and I rubbed at them, sure that I had mistaken the two suns for something else. When I opened my eyes, the suns were still there. I forced myself upright and treaded water. To my right was a sandy beach and forest beyond. To my left was a tall, rocky cliff. I didn't know where I was, but I was pretty damn sure it wasn't Earth.
Chapter 2.
Gibson, do you read me? I called on the radio. Team 1, Team 2, anyone? No one answered in my earpiece, so I continued to tread water and wonder where the hell I had ended up. The turquoise water suggested the Caribbean, but the twin suns made it pretty obvious that I was no longer on Earth. More importantly, could I get back? Those and other questions rattled around my brain as I tried to stay above water. Even though my molly pack was buoyant, it still weighed at least 70 pounds, but I had trained under similar conditions, and I had always been a good swimmer. The adrenaline combined with my confusion and fear of whatever might be lurking beneath the water got my ass in gear pretty quick, and I began swimming to shore.
"Ho there!"
A voice came from behind me. I turned around in the water to see who it was. The waves were mild, and as I bobbed up over the waterline, I saw a lone fisherman in a little boat about 100 yards away from me. The shore was perhaps twice as far away, and I knew I could make the swim, but I figured I might as well catch a ride.
"Oh, there, I'm coming, hold on."
The fisherman was eager to get to me, and the urgency in his voice suggested that these weren't waters which people swam in often, or perhaps he thought that I was being pulled out by the current. Regardless, he was coming to help, so I turned and started to swim in his direction. A wave began to grow in front of me, and I dove beneath it rather than crash through. I kept my eyes open when I went under the water, and I soon wished that I hadn't. Below me, three sharks circled. They didn't look like great whites or tiger sharks or any kind I had ever seen, but they sure as hell made my skeleton want to leap out of my skin and run across the water like a cartoon character. I redoubled my efforts and tried to remind myself that sharks didn't usually attack people unless they had mistaken them for seals, or they were bleeding from tumbling head over ass down a rocky slope. With renewed vigor, I swam for my life and tried hard not to look like a seal.
"Here, grab hold of this,"
the fisherman yelled. He thrust out one of his oars and nearly took my head off, but I grabbed a hold of it and welcomed his help as I struggled to get my soggy ass into the boat. My fear of the sharks made me clumsy, and I crashed to the bottom of the boat and knocked over his fishing pole. I also managed to spill a bucket of minnows, and they jumped, flipped, and slapped me in the face as they fought to find water. Shit, my bad. I tried to round up the minnows, but then I knocked over the fisherman's tackle as I flailed around his small boat.
"It's all right, son. Never mind them. Was done for the day anyway,"
the fisherman assured me. He tugged on my molly pack and helped me to sit on the seat at the helm of the small rowboat.
"Thanks," I gasped as I tried to catch my breath. "Name's Torrance," the fisherman said as he extended a hand.
It, like his face and the rest of his exposed skin, was dark brown and leathery. It suggested a life spent working outdoors beneath the sun. Or, in this case, beneath two suns.
"Sergeant Ken Jewell," I said as we shook hands. "Thanks for the help."
"You're welcome, friend," said the fisherman with a kind smile.
Torrance had a firm, rough grip, but an easy smile and kind brown eyes. He watched me with mild amusement and more than a small dose of curiosity. I noticed that he studied my camo and his eyes squinted when he read the tags on my left shoulder.
"What's a sapper, Sergeant Ken Jewell?"
"You can call me Ken," I said and glanced around at the foreign landscape. This guy could read English, so I started to think that maybe I was still on Earth.
"Can I ask you a question?"
"Sure."
Where the hell am I? He squinted at me and was probably trying to gauge if I was loony.
Why? You're in my boat.
I know that. I mean, what is this place? And how the hell did I get here?
As for where we are, he said and waved a hand toward the land, we are in the Bay of Myrrh, about 3 miles north of Hampstead. As for how you got here, well, you just kind of fell out of the sky.
I fell from the sky? I looked up and expected to see some sort of shimmering portal or maybe even a UFO, but I saw only faint clouds, blue skies, and the twin suns that enforced the fact that there was no way in hell I was on Earth. Their rays burst through the clouds at different angles and chased a mean-looking thunderhead inland.
Yep, he said. I was sitting here fishing like I do every day. The fish bite best when both suns are out, you know. And then I heard your screaming. I looked up and saw you falling into the water.
Did you see anything else?
I don't catch your meaning, he said.
Did you see, like, a shiny metal craft or maybe a shimmering, portal? I inquired and realized quickly how insane I sounded.
Portal? Like a magic portal?
He scratched at his 2-day beard and considered that.
Didn't see one, but that might explain things. You anger a witch or something?
A witch, I repeated with a nervous laugh. But he was serious, and I cleared my throat and shook my head.
Not that I know of, sir. Well, a witch would explain things. Could have been that, or a fairy,
Torrance said matter-of-factly. I rubbed my saltwater-stung eyes, squeezed the bridge of my nose, and tried to figure out what the hell was going on. This place seemed real, and Torrance seemed as real as anyone I had ever met, if a bit strange. I thought about my men and wondered what had happened to them. The drone most likely took out the fighters around the truck that Fire Team 1 had locked down, and with that team freed up, they had most likely rushed to the aid of Team 2. I hoped so, anyway. My conscience wouldn't let the nagging questions rest, so I tried to focus on the problem at hand. No matter what had happened to my men, I couldn't do anything about it at the moment. I needed to concentrate on my own predicament.
You look like you've had a hell of a day,
Torrance said, and he began to row toward shore.
How about we go back to my farm and eat us some of this catch, and maybe then we can puzzle out what happened to you?
Thank you, I said. I craned my neck around to study the beach. There were no palm trees or any of the other trappings of the Caribbean. Instead, thick green grass littered the sand dunes, and farther inland, a tall forest of pine surrounded the bay. On the other side of the bay was a long shelf of stone that created a sheer cliff at least 100 feet high that jutted out from the earth like a colossal finger. We made landfall, and I helped Torrance pull in his fishing boat. Then we dragged it across the beach, and I secured it behind one of the dozen or so sand dunes while Torrance collected his catch. 5 red fish, about a foot long, and a pair of crustaceans that he had caught in a net. They looked like a cross between a crab and scorpion, but I would have eaten anything right about then. The thought of food made my stomach growl. I had skipped breakfast that morning, since I didn't want to take a dump while on duty, and all I had eaten during the mission was an energy bar from one of my MREs. Cooked fish sounded pretty damn good. "Let me help you carry something," I suggested, but Torrance shook his head and shouldered his gear.
"Nonsense, you're my guest. Besides, it looks to me like you've got enough on your shoulders."
I glanced back at my molly pack. "I'm used to it." He nodded agreeably, and I watched as his eyes moved over my utility belt and the M17 handgun holstered on my hip. He didn't seem to recognize it as a weapon, and he gave me another smile as he gestured away from the boat. I took a better look at his clothes and gear as we moved out of the trees. His fishing pole was nothing more than a long piece of bamboo with a line twisted around it, and the knife holstered on his thigh looked like an ancient artifact. His brown trousers appeared to be made of hemp, and his leather jerkin and sandals seemed to be handmade. Either he was a hippie, or I had landed in a world with technology a few centuries removed from Earth.
"What are you lugging around in that big bag of yours?"
he said as he started down a well-worn trail. Supplies? I said as I followed close behind him and surveyed the land like I was still in enemy territory. For all I knew, I still was. Where are you from? He asked. A land far from here? I said as I reminded myself not to give too much info. I liked the guy, sure, but I didn't know him or this place. Any information I gave him could potentially be used against me, and until I knew I could trust the man, I didn't want to give him too much info. Oh? He said and waited for me to elaborate. When I didn't, he continued the conversation.
Well, wherever you're from, it ain't no place I've ever been. Never seen clothes like yours, and I can't place your accent. But a man has got a right to keep his own secrets, eh?
I suppose so. He nodded to himself and glanced back.
You a married man, Ken?
Nope, not married. You?
Was.
He made some sort of sign in the air with his right hand, like a big S.
Her name was Mildred. Lost her to a kobold raiding party a few years back.
I'm sorry. I don't think I heard you right, I said as I reached a finger in my ear to clean out some of the water.
A kobold raiding party, he repeated.
Kobold? Like the creatures from Dungeons and Dragons?
We have both dungeons and dragons, he said with a shrug. Where are you talking about a place? You seem kinda confused.
Yeah, I said, just because I realized that a fisherman from another world wouldn't know about the tabletop game.
I ain't never heard of that land, but they were kobolds, all right. I told her not to go out that night, but her sister was sick, you see, so she left as soon as she got word. Was the last time I saw her alive.
I stopped in my tracks and glanced around. I thought for sure someone would pop up out of the tall grass and tell me I was on a hidden camera show, but no one did, so I hurried to catch up to Torrance. We came out on a well-worn dirt road on which the tanned fisherman headed west. At least I thought it was west. I retrieved my lensatic compass from my utility belt, and the needle pointed away from the ocean, toward the forest of pine, which confirmed that we were indeed headed west. I glanced at the suns to confirm our direction, and one looked to be 4 or 5 hours from setting, but the other trailed a few hours behind the first.
I'm sorry for your loss, I told Torrance.
She's in a better place now, he said. At least where she went, there ain't no monsters, on account of the beasts not having souls.
You mean there are other things besides kobolds in this land? I said as I realized that he had not only been serious about the witch, but the fairy as well. He stopped and turned to regard me with confusion again.
You telling me that where you're from there ain't no monsters?
I didn't want to seem more foreign than I must have already appeared, so I shrugged and said,
Sure, there are monsters, but they're rare.
He nodded.
Well, you're a lucky one, then. This country is crawling with monsters. There are entire cities of the beasts down in the Underdark. I guess it's a blessing that they only come out at night, though, on account of not being able to tolerate the suns.
Yeah, I said. Our monsters only come out at night, too. He pointed into the woods on the right side of the road.
See that there?
I followed his finger and saw what looked to be a cave entrance, but it was all boarded up and blocked off by heavy stones.
They come out of caves like that and other less conspicuous holes in the ground, Torrance explained. They're like blasted moles, they are, always digging their tunnels through the land. You close one hole off, and they make two more. But there haven't been many raids lately, thank the Holy Twins.
By Holy Twins, I assumed he meant the two sons, but I didn't bother asking, since I already looked like I didn't belong here. We continued west, down the dirt road and away from the ocean, and soon the pine forest loomed on both sides. It was nice to get into the shade of the trees for a bit, since the two sons left few places to find a reprieve. Shadows didn't work right here, and it was a little hard for my eyes and my brain to get used to all the light. The scents of the forest rode on a mild wind, and the smell was a familiar comfort in the unfamiliar land. It smelled like it had rained recently, and the freshness of the pine combined with the musk of the forest floor helped to calm my nerves.
A chorus of birds sang in the forest, accompanied by the chittering of chipmunks and the steady rhythm of grasshoppers and other bugs. We arrived at Torrance's farm 10 minutes later. It was a decent-sized plot of land, from what I could see. A modest, one-story cottage sat beside an old, weathered barn facing north. There was a hay field to the west of the house, and a one-acre garden to the east. Behind the buildings, there was a long, sprawling apple orchard. A wagon sat parked between the house and the barn, and livestock grazed in a roped-off area to the left of the buildings. There were about a dozen cows that reminded me of Black Angus, a few goats, and a couple pigs. Chickens had free rein of the property and pecked happily at the ground as we walked toward the house. The homestead reminded me of an Amish paradise, and it seemed a lot like Earth, except for the two suns in the sky. Torrance led me inside and plopped the catch down on a sturdy-looking table. The inside of the cottage was well lit by the sunlight shining in through the many windows on the north wall. The place was cozy, and the smell reminded me of my dad's beloved meat smoker. Aside from the table and 6 chairs, there was a sitting area with a few wicker chairs situated beside the big fireplace. Across from that was the cooking area centered on an open hearth. The fireplace was wide and lined on both sides with stacked wood set to dry. Sausage and herbs hung from the top of the hearth, and a cast-iron pot set on a swivel slowly simmered. The aroma of vegetable soup found my nose, and hunger pangs tore at my stomach.
"You need some dry clothes?" Torrance asked.
"No, thanks. I've got some in my pack." He nodded and pointed to a hallway to the left of the cooking hearth.
"You can go on and clean up in the washroom. Second door on the left. I'll clean up these beauties and pour us some spirits in the meantime."
"That sounds great. Thanks, Torrance." I went to the washroom and discovered that it came complete with a water basin fed by a hand pump and an outhouse-style shitter. There was even a stack of what looked like old shredded newspaper if I needed to wipe my ass. A mirror hung above the basin, and I was surprised at how wild-eyed and disheveled I looked. My brown hair had bits of seaweed in it, and my usually clear brown eyes were bloodshot and tired-looking. Dried blood speckled my right cheek from the flecks of sandstone that had been kicked up by the gunfire back on Earth, and I had a big welt on my temple from knocking into the wall on my tumble down the hole.
"What the fuck is going on?" I asked my reflection. "Where am I?"
"You say something, Ken?" Torrance yelled from the kitchen.
"No, sorry, just talking to myself." I rolled my eyes at my reflection. Torrance must have already thought I was a bit odd, and admitting to talking to myself probably didn't help matters. I shouldered off my molly pack and set to cleaning myself up. My clothes were still wet from my little swim, so I undressed and folded them up before putting them aside. In the water basin, I scrubbed my face of the dried blood, washed out my hair, and then splashed water on the rest of my body to get the salt from the ocean off me. I had soap in my molly pack, but I didn't want to use any of my supplies yet if I didn't have to. With a quick glance around the shelves of the washroom, I found a bar of soap. It smelled like lilies, and I was surprised at how refreshed I felt after I washed with it. When I was done cleaning myself up, I retrieved the waterproofing bag out of my pack and took out an extra pair of camouflage utility pants, a dry t-shirt, wool socks, and combat boots. I started to put the bag away, but decided to wear my patrol cap as well. I dressed in my dry clothes and strapped on my utility belt. It was still a bit damp, but my M17 handgun was holstered to it, and I didn't feel comfortable without the sidearm. I realized that the weapon had also taken a dip in the ocean with me, and while the handguns were super durable, it was easy enough to take it apart and wash the salt off the barrel and springs. When I was done cleaning my gun, I glanced at my watch. It reported 3 p.m., and I was surprised that I had only been in this strange new world for less than an hour. It seemed like days since I had fallen into that damned sinkhole in Syria, and not for the first time today I seriously began to question my sanity. By the time I returned to the kitchen with my pack slung over my shoulder and my wet clothes in hand, Torrance had finished cleaning the fish, and he had already poured 2 small glasses of amber spirits.
"Ah," he said when he saw me, "you look all refreshed. Have a drink with me?"
"You don't have to ask me twice," I said as I put down my clothes on top of my molly pack. He handed me one of the glasses, and I inspected the 3 fingers of amber liquor. A quick sniff told me that it had a high alcohol content, and I felt my mouth curl into a smile. The liquid reminded me of bourbon, but with an intense, smoky aroma. If I had to be stranded on another planet, I was glad it was one with liquor. "What should we drink to?" I asked, and I hoped he knew what I meant. Rule number one about visiting a new territory was never eat or drink their stuff, since it might make you sick, but I knew I wasn't on Earth anymore, and this guy had no reason to poison me.
Torrance thought about that as he held up his glass and scratched his stubbly chin.
Then his face lit up and he smiled wide, showing off his impressively straight white teeth. "To new friends," he suggested. "To new friends," I said as I tapped his glass with mine, tapped the table, and tossed it down with one big gulp. It washed through my belly like molten lava, and my skin prickled all the way from the top of my head to the tips of my toes. When I exhaled, I half expected flames to shoot out of my mouth.
"Looks like you enjoyed it," Torrance laughed.
"Damn, that'll straighten the short and curlies," I replied with a cough, despite being a somewhat seasoned drinker. Torrance laughed.
"Those are true words. This spirit is one of my favorites. Here, give me your wet clothes and I'll have Matilda hang them up to dry for you. She's my daughter, sweet as her mother she is. I've got two boys as well. Or did I tell you that already? I tend to repeat myself sometimes, so don't be afraid to let me know if I do. You won't offend me."
All right, and no, you haven't, sir," I said as I handed him my clothes. After 15 minutes of sipping the alcohol and chatting about the weather, Torrance called his kids to dinner. He had added the fish to the vegetable soup that simmered in the cast-iron pot, and the aroma made my mouth water. When the kids came in, I was introduced to Matilda, 16, a waif of a girl with brown hair and dimples, who averted her eyes to the floor coyly when she spoke. Her two brothers, Marcus and Maximus, looked to be about 6 or so years younger. They both stared at my clothes and my hat and ogled my utility belt. Both had brown hair like their sister, but they were big and strong for their ages, no doubt from their years of hard farm work.
"What's that?"
Maximus asked, pointing at my holstered gun.
"Can I hold your knife?"
his brother chimed in.
"Boys, where are your manners?" their father asked with a scowl. "Quit ogling our guest like a bunch of sneaking goblins and go on and get washed up, or we'll start without you."
Marcus ignored his father and pointed at my molly pack in the corner.
"What's in there?"
he asked suspiciously.
"Mind your pa!"
Matilda suddenly screeched and slapped the boy upside the head. She turned a coy glance back toward me and blushed as the boys yipped and scampered off.
"That a girl," Torrance laughed. "Just like her mother. She'll make a good wife someday, she will, for some lucky fellow."
I got the feeling that he was insinuating that she would make a good wife for me, and a quick glance at the girl told me exactly how she felt about the idea. She batted her eyes and let those dimples do their darndest, but besides the fact she was way too young, I had more important things to worry about right now. Torrance indicated the seat across from his at the head of the table, and I sat with Matilda to my right. The boys ran back into the kitchen like a whirlwind and fought each other for the seat closest to me on my left. Marcus won and gave his brother a punch in the arm for good measure.
"Pa!"
Maximus protested and rubbed his arm.
"Take it out back of the barn where it belongs, or else shut your yappers,"
he told them as he offered me a gracious smile.
"Would you like to say a blessing?"
"I'm not sure." I had never been a religious man, and I certainly had never said grace. We just didn't do that in my family.
"We'd be honored," the fisherman said as he gestured to his family.
I nodded, and everyone clasped their hands together and then twisted their wrists up so that the palms were facing upward in a kind of offering. I mimicked the awkward pose and closed my eyes. My mind raced to think of the right words, and a quick peek showed me that everyone still waited patiently. Then I remembered Torrance's name for the sons. "Holy twins," I began shakily, but then cleared my throat. "Holy twins, thank you for this bountiful meal set before us. Thank you for Torrance and his wonderful family. May you bless their farm and give them all long, happy lives. Amen.
Amen?
Marcus asked. I opened my eyes, worried that I had broken some unspoken etiquette, but Matilda came to my defense swiftly.
It was a wonderful blessing, she hissed at Marcus, and then she smiled sweetly at me.
He forgot to make the sign,
Maximus pointed out. I recalled the sign that Torrance had made when he spoke of his late wife, and then I drew a big S in the air in front of me. The others followed suit, and Torrance nodded happily.
Dig in,
he urged, and I eagerly started to shovel food onto my plate. A half hour later, I leaned back in my chair and patted my full belly. Matilda cleaned up the table, and the boys sat quietly and listened to Torrance and I as we talked about his farm and animals. The old farmer lit up a pipe and offered one to me, but I declined, never having been a smoker. Tea was served shortly after, and Matilda laid out some strawberry tarts. I wolfed down four of them and chased them with lemon-flavored tea while Torrance puffed on his pipe. The cherry-scented smoke hovered above his head like a thick halo and coalesced pleasantly with the fading smell of dinner.
"So, tell me, Ken, what power do you have?"
he asked, and the boys turned to me with excitement.
"Power?"
I said through a mouthful of tarts.
"Abilities, gifts. I'm talking about magic powers, son."
I don't think I have any,
I admitted, and by the looks on their faces, I might as well have told them that my pecker grew out of my forehead.
"You don't have one?"
Torrance said with a disturbed look in his eyes.
"Well, you should. You're well over the age when they present themselves. Or don't your people have magic?"
Let's bring him to Gran Helga in Hampstead,
Matilda said excitedly.
Yeah,
Maximus cheered.
Can we, Pa?
Marcus begged.
Who's Gran Helga? I asked.
She's the local magic teller,
Maximus said.
She'll read the stars to find your power.
She's a witch,
Marcus exclaimed and made big eyes at me.
Settle down now, their father told them.
He gazed at me for a long time while he puffed on his pipe and a slow grin grew on his face.
What do you think about going to see the witch, Ken?
I don't know. I don't want to waste your time. Truth was, I didn't want to waste my own time. I needed to figure out how to get back to Earth, but I didn't want to be rude to my host. On second thought, it sounds like a great idea. I realized that if this Gran Helga character was a real witch, she might be able to help get me home. Torrance had asked if I angered a witch, and he had insinuated that they knew how to create portals. Maybe she was my best bet.
Great, he said as he rose from the table. Go on, Marcus, Maximus. Get the horses and the wagon ready. Might as well show Ken our little village. You up for that, Ken?
Sure. Let me check on my clothes. They should be dry by now. I gathered my clothes from the clothesline. They were still a little damp, but they were dry enough. I changed back into my heavy fatigues in the washroom and folded my t-shirt, wool socks, and camo pants, and returned them to the waterproof bag. 10 minutes later, Torrance, Matilda, the two boys, and myself were riding down the long driveway toward the dirt road in an open-air wagon. Everyone had changed out of their farming clothes and now donned what looked like their Sunday best. Torrance wore a pair of fine brown slacks, a puffy white shirt with a ruffled collar and frilly cuffs. Over the shirt, he wore a leather jerkin, the same color as his trousers. Shiny leather boots and a Robin Hood-looking hat with a feather in it finished the look. The boys wore a version of their father's attire, and Matilda wore a long green dress embroidered with moons and stars. She had applied some coloring to her eyes and cheeks as well, and she kept shooting me shy smiles as we rode. All in all, they looked like they were headed to a Renaissance fair. They were simple country people, but they conducted themselves with pride and dignity. They were my kind of folk, and even though I was far away from home, I felt myself smile. As we rode, Torrance became increasingly excited by the idea of me having my stars read.
I tell you what, I bet it's a great power that you possess. You've got that look about you.
Maybe he can shoot lightning out of his fingertips,
Maximus conjectured.
Or fart fire, Marcus put in.
Now that would be something else, I exclaimed, but I would probably set fire to my bed when I farted in my sleep. The boys rolled with laughter in the back of the wagon, and Matilda covered her mouth while she giggled. Torrance's merry chuckle added to the joyful chorus, and I found myself joining in. Then a thought occurred to me, and I turned to the farmer. "Torrance, what's your ability, if you don't mind my asking?"
"Not at all, not at all!"
He slapped the reins and clicked to the horses as they turned onto the road. The old farmer stuck out a thumb in my direction and waggled it a little. His eyebrows danced, and I realized that he wanted me to guess.
"Do you have super hitchhiking abilities?" I asked.
"Ha! What's that? No, no. I've got a green thumb."
"Pa can make anything grow in any kind of soil," Marcus said excitedly.
That must come in handy. What about you, Matilda?" I said and glanced back at the second row seat. As expected, she was blushing.
"I'm not yet of age," she whispered.
"It'll be another 2 years before Matilda stands before Gran Helga to be read," the farmer explained. "But my coin is on her having my ability. They usually run in the family, but crossways like, daughters get the power of their fathers and sons get the power of their mothers. Not always, mind you, but most of the time."
I wondered what I was about to get myself into as we rode through the forest. I doubted that I even had a power in this world, let alone two, like Torrance said sometimes happened when he explained how the powers worked. But then again, I hadn't woken up that morning thinking that I would fall through a portal to another world, either. The idea of having a magical ability started to appeal to me. Having a magical power seemed like it would be pretty awesome. We crested a hill, and a straight-up medieval village grew from the valley below. The one- and two-story cottages looked like they had jumped right out of a Thomas Kincaid painting. They had thatched roofs, wattle and daub walls with a few exposed beams which crisscrossed each other or outlined the rooms within. A small river snaked its way through the village from north to south, and I guessed that it spilled out into the ocean. A few windmills stood on the banks of the river, and two stone bridges offered travelers a way over the body of water. Deeper into the village, the buildings shed their wattle and daub walls for stone and heavy lumber, and the roofs changed from simple thatch to thick shingle shakes. I hadn't seen many castles in my day, but there was no mistaking the large building that sat on the distant hill for anything else but that. "Who lives there?" I asked Torrance as I pointed at the distant castle.
"That would be Duke Belfry," Torrance said.
"Ah," I said. "The big cheese." He laughed at that one.
"Never heard it said that way, but I guess it's correct. Belfry owns all the land you see and a lot of what you don't."
"Is this like a fiefdom or something?" I asked.
"Yep, you see, you aren't so far out of your element here," he said merrily. "A few weeks with us and you'll fit right in."
He steered the horses into the village and tipped his hat to a group of women walking by. The ladies looked to be in their 40s, and they covered their mouths with their hands and whispered to each other as their eyes stared at me. I knew that they were gossiping about me, and who could blame them? I was in the middle of a medieval village wearing full army garb, and I got about as many looks as I would have received if I walked through an army barracks in a tutu. The village reminded me of a set from Game of Thrones. It contained a blacksmith, a livery, a church that donned a big S rather than a cross, a butcher shop, and a small schoolhouse. There were also a number of quaint shops, along with numerous open markets that offered everything from fresh vegetables to pickled pig's feet. The smell of manure was almost overwhelming, but no one else seemed to mind. Torrance didn't apologize to me for his nosy neighbors, but instead yelled to them like a carnival barker.
"Don't stare, a painting lasts longer. Come on, follow us. We've a visitor from another land whose stars have never been read before."
I pretended to be blocking out the suns and hid my face as the people ogled us and started to murmur. Within 5 minutes, it seemed that the message had reached every corner of the village, and by the time we stopped in front of the witch Gran Helga's little hut by the river, more than 100 citizens of Hampstead had gathered to see what was going on.
"Come on, don't be shy," Torrance urged. He looked to be enjoying himself immensely, and I saw the glimmer of stardom in his eyes.
I reluctantly climbed down from the wagon, and the crowd gasped and murmured to each other.
I made out random comments about how strange my clothes were, and speculation about whether I was a warrior of some sort. Other people scowled and spit on the ground, mumbling about foreigners and keeping to your